questions you like to ask in an interview that you think cut through things? Maybe they're a little provocative. Is there anything in particular that you love to ask in an interview session that you think is really good?
Tell me about a time where you messed up and something you'll never do again. Mm. It's simple, it's basic, but you get to test the humility. Sometimes people have to think about it. And if they have to think a really long time, it's one of two things. They haven't taken enough risks, or they're trying to figure out how to spin the story.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to executives and founders who are disrupting and changing companies and industries about what they uniquely see when it comes to identifying top talent. If this is your first episode, welcome. We are so glad to have you. If you're a longtime listener, thank you for the continued support. I ask everybody goes and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure you subscribe to the pod and give us a great rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. I'm very excited about this. I recently read her book. We spent time talking. She's one of the foremost thought leaders in artificial intelligence, a topic that everybody is super excited about. 10 patents, Amazon tech exec, four-time C-suite officer at Fortune 100s, best-selling author, Sahl Rashidi. Sahl, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here.
You are somebody that every time that we've talked, I come away, just my head is spinning. I'm thinking about new things and new ideas. You are at the forefront of an area that is on everybody's mind right now. So I want to dive right into it. So one of the things about artificial intelligence that everybody agrees on is, okay, number one, this is very important. It's going to fundamentally change everything that we do, from consumers to business behavior and everything in between. The analogy I heard the other day is like, AI is like electricity. Like, it's just going to be like accepted as part of fundamentally everything that we do from a work and consumer perspective. It's not a feature, right? So that's it's a paradigm shift for some people, because they're looking at it as like, how do we get into AI? It's like AI is intrinsic into everything you're building, everything you're doing. But the thing about AI that's interesting is the adoption patterns, or how to best deploy it. When I talk to some of the smartest people I know, there's a lot of vagueness. There's a lot of ambiguity. There's a lot of guesswork. And what I love about talking to you, of anybody I've talked to, you are the person that seems to have the most depth in this space and the firmest conclusions. Not necessarily that you have all the answers, but you've been doing this for so long. You actually started your career, or got your big break in your career, from reading your book, I know this, with IBM and Watson, which is really the first kind of advent of artificial intelligence at its core. So let's talk through that. Tell us a little bit about your journey into this space, right, and where you first started, and why you've been spending over a decade in an area that's relatively new for most people.
You know, I got into the data processing space in the late 90s, not the sexiest. Fun fact, I played professional rugby. I went to school to play rugby. I played Division I and then club, and then I was in the U.S. national team. And, you know, as you get older, recovery takes longer. And I was like, oh, crap, I think I got to hang up the cleats. And I applied to a bunch of jobs, and the first offer I got was to be a data engineer, because I was a chemical engineer at Berkeley. I didn't know anything about data engineering. But like with anything, you adapt, you learn, you figure it out, you're resourceful, you study the heck out of the material until you can kind of get yourself to a productive point. And then the career could just kind of Christmas tree its way up, but I was always in the data space. It's not something you choose. It wasn't even a career I thought was a career choice, to be honest with you. Long story short, it turns out that in that space, you have brilliant data engineers, you have brilliant modelers, you have brilliant infrastructure folks. However, the one thing that they lacked was the ability to communicate with the business and the executives. And that was the one thing that I did excel at. I was a mediocre data engineer, but I was a phenomenal communicator. And so what ended up happening was, is I got recruited by the Big Four, and I ended up choosing IBM. And I was a lead, I was an individual contributor and a practitioner working on these massive ERP migrations, and I was the data lead. Then I managed the team, then I managed a group, then I managed the P&L. And then one thing pivotal happened. You know, if we all think about those moments in life that completely changed our trajectory, this was probably, and it's mentioned in the book, the third or fourth one. 2011, Watson beat Ken Jennings. And IBM decided, we're gonna go live with Watson. We're ready to commercialize this platform. It's got notoriety, it's got commercial recognition, let's take it. Well, unfortunately, I think most people wait for things to happen to them. I've just have never been of that mindset. I've always pursued the things that I wanted. And I gracefully begged my boss's boss, who knew me, I want in. I want in, Jay. Jay, I want in. You can't do AI without data. No, no one knew that. I didn't know that, but I was like, that sounds common sense. And so after 4 months of gracefully begging, he let me in. And I traveled around the world and I worked with all the early adopters and I was developing AI strategies, helping them with use case selection back in 2011. So 2011 to 2014 was literally strategy, use case development. And then I would actually work with all the product engineers and the platforms team to actually develop the product based on what I sold or what I was advising. So I was flying the plane and building it at the same time with Watson. I was like, oh, this is how product development works. This is amazing. It was a great ride. Then I got hired by Ernst & Young as their senior partner to manage their digital innovation track. And I got the luxurious opportunity of having Royal Caribbean as my client. In 2015 and 16, they were going through a major digital transformation program, 4-year endeavor. I was a lead partner leading data and tech and AI-ish type activities. And then about a year in, they asked me to join their leadership team. So in 2016, I was appointed as the first chief data and AI officer in our own local town in Miami. But since then, I've had great, just wonderful, wonderful positions that have been a lot of fun. I went to Sony Music as their executive vice president and CDO, Merck Pharmaceuticals as their chief data and analytics officer, Estee Lauder as their chief analytics officer, and everything always had data analytics, advanced analytics, and an AI innovation lab because we were building products and embedded within our products were AI-based capabilities. So it was a lot of fun. But then, as I had mentioned, I resigned from enterprise and I said, I'm ready to do my own thing for a while. But now I'm back into the belly of the beast, if you will.
Enterprise is a completely different animal. And I would say fundamentally, the skill sets that drive success in enterprise are so different than what they do in a startup and small medium business. So your ability to vacillate is really impressive. And it's not one that I know a lot of people that can handle with such smoothness. A couple of things I want to dive into here, because I want to talk about the book and I got a lot out of it. But I want to ask you this. And you were very gracious about your time at IBM and your role and what you did with Watson. But here's what I would ask you. I feel like IBM had such a head start, right, on this space. And I don't know if I asked a lot of people who are the top five players in the AI space that IBM's name would come up. So do you have like a fundamental reason on why that's the case? Or was it just like, I mean, what was missing there that they're not far and away the leader in this space since they started really in 2011 and pre-2011?
So what I always say is, one, IBM doesn't get the credit it deserves. Two, IBM has launched a lot of things behind the scenes, whether it be research, baseline capabilities. But three, remember, being first to market has an advantage and a major disadvantage. You're working through the kinks as you're commercializing a potential. And so we started with two primary industries, financial services and healthcare. Well, what do they have in common? Massive, lots of cash, lots of data,
highly regulated
regulations.
Yeah.
Subject matter expertise is 1000% needed. And we didn't have enough subject matter expertise to be able to train all the different capabilities and models that we had. And there were a lot of other mishaps, of course. But when you're first to market, there's no prior person, entity, organization, or precedence. So you're learning while you're doing. And I think that's why it just doesn't get the credit that it deserves. People learned off of IBM's back. Now, there could have been different decisions that were made to keep it a prominent figure. And I know they've rebranded Watson as Watson X. They're still selling a ton and they're still doing amazing things. And there's some brilliant, brilliant individuals there, no doubt.
Good answer. I love that. Shout out Big Blue. And that is some good perspective there because I think I wouldn't be the only person that maybe thought of it that way. But I think you characterize that in a really, really good way that coming first to market is not easy. The industries they chose are not always easy. They went through a lot of the bumps. They crawled so a lot of other companies could run, right?
At the 100%. End. 100%.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. So let's talk about your book now. All right. So I'm going to pontificate a little bit here. I'm gonna tell you your AI survival guide. So I got this when we first met. I read it. I wanted to be prepared for the podcast. So a couple different things about it. First, I love that you started with your story and kind of acclimating as, you know, coming from a different country and having a different background as somebody who comes from a mixed race. You grew up in America. I felt a lot. I was reading it and feeling a lot of the same things that you did. I want to talk about why you decided to write the book, but then outside of that, you then take that kind of personal knowledge about you and who you are and how you grew, and then you put together one of the most tactical, strong playbooks I've seen for AI deployment in enterprise companies, in small and medium businesses. Like, this is one of the topics that comes up to me with a lot of executives I talk to on kind of trying to figure out what we do here. And I would recommend this book highly to anybody, even if just to give you a frame of reference. But there's so many nuggets in here that you can apply day one that I think are really, really good. I got to be honest with you. I'm not just saying this because you're here. Really a masterclass on how you manage, right, stakeholders in an enterprise environment. Because you understand it's as much about the roles, the responsibilities, the communication, the getting the buy-in, things like that. So let's start here. I've gone very deep. You did. So here's the thing. You talked about your rugby. So I think I know the answer is which you're the best at. But you were also a swimmer and water polo player. Which sport did you love the most? Was it rugby?
It was rugby. It was gritty. It was salt of the earth. It was, my best friends are still from when I played rugby. Oddly enough, I went to Berkeley to play water polo, but I never, and I think there's a section in the book, you know, you could be a phenomenal high school athlete. You can get recruited to a Division I and you can be second string to second string once you get there. And that's what happened to me. So I was swimming 5-6 hours a day. And like my sophomore year, like I just had no game time. And the game is what you swim and practice for. You know, think about it, like dry, brittle hair, like the skin is drying up. You smell like chlorine 24/7. You're like, is this worth it? I'm not even getting game time. So I talked to my coach, Mo. I was like, listen, Mo, is there a career? Like, is there a future? He's like, Sol, love your tenacity, love your energy. But you're like 5'4 on a good day. Everyone else is 5'11, 6 feet. Like just physically, you're not built for this level, even though your power and your discipline has helped compensate your height deficiency up until this point. But you're at a different league now. And I was like, oh, that sucks. Long story short, I decided to focus on my academics and I resigned. And that same week, the rugby coach had discovered me. And she said, what sport do you play? And I said, until a few days ago, water polo. She's like, have you ever tried rugby? I was like, no. She's like, I think you're going to be natural at it. Well, it turns out every deficiency I had in water polo was actually a strength in rugby. One, I had the ball handling skills because in water polo, you're treading. Imagine what you can do on ground. I was 5'3", 5'4", which was a deficiency in water polo, but it was a great strength in rugby because lower center of gravity, harder to tackle, harder to fold. That was kind of like the first big lesson in resilience. Environment plays a big, big influence on your ability to thrive. And sometimes it's not about quitting, but knowing your shelf life within a specific environment. And so that's how the pivot happens.
So I love that. So I don't think anybody would have guessed that as you pop up on the YouTube screen that you are a successful rugby player. So I'm so glad we got into that. Another parallel I'm drawing is I'm realizing that my brother played water polo all throughout high school and went to Berkeley. So there's some synergy there.
And we have the same last name. There's like too many.
There's a little bit too many coincidences. There might be some separation of birth type situation here. And then lastly, I love what you just said. I read something the other day that really resonated with me. And I've been saying this for a while. I remember at one point early on in my career, I really wanted to focus on what my weaknesses were, where I spend a lot of time getting better at those. And what I realized is that that's a false idol. Like chasing that thought process, I think to me, doesn't make a ton of sense. Lean into your strengths. And if your strengths don't ultimately lead to the success you want, then change your environment. Because to your point, those strengths matter in other ways. So much like being 5'10", 6 foot in water polo makes a lot of sense because you can throw the ball and you can stand in the water, right? Or float in the water. In rugby, your low center of gravity actually played to your strengths. And then you went and played it in college. So I think that's a wonderful lesson and one that a lot of people would take well to take heed of.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
I got a couple more things personally. Yeah. So I want to talk about, because my name is, my full name is Usman, but I've gone by Oz since I was in kindergarten. Second grade, you got the nickname Soul, by a substitute. Yeah, totally. Can you tell the story?
Yeah. My parents moved, left LA, which is where I was born. It was getting a bit dangerous. And so they moved to Orange County right before it became the OC and like became all popularized. Think about this. I'm 46. Like this was 40 years ago. I was the only colored girl in the neighborhood. I developed a lot quicker than everyone else. You know, I remember everyone was putting sun in their hair to go blonde. I put sun in thinking I'd be blonde and I just turned orange. I looked like just a big old Balloompa. It was horrendous. The things you learn. But second grade roll call, the teacher, and it was like, I think it was the first week. It was Jennifer, Sarah, Rachel, Krista, Michael, Braden, Brian, Jason, Jennifer, Melissa. Like I got to my name and I raised my hand because I was like, that's got to be me because you could pronounce every other American name in it. And he just said, to hell with this. He's like, I'm not going to even try and butcher this. I'm taking the first three letters instead of Solmaz, which is S-O-L-M-A-Z. Sol it is, S-O-L. And so it was a turning point, like the first one, because it wasn't no, hey, you, or hey, brown girl, or you, it was Sol. And it just stuck. And I was like, well, it's short, it's easy, it's memorable. I'm just going to keep it. I haven't legally changed it, but everything goes under Sol.
So I love that story. So here's mine. In kindergarten, I don't know if it was my dad or my mom. I think it was my dad just told him that he goes by Oz. But the thing that's really interesting about what you just said is I dreaded, right? So the only two people that call me by my full name is my since deceased grandmother and my mother. Everybody else knows me as Oz at this point. But what's
really?
So what's funny about this is that I remember – and you're kind of like bringing me back in a little bit of PTSD. One of my most kind of anxious moments, and I didn't know the word anxiety back then. I don't think many of us did. Now it's kind of something you're much, much more aware of. But when a substitute would come into class and I would know whose name comes after what. And I would like stop them off the bat before they were like, oh, ooze, goo. Like they could pronounce it and just be like, it's Oz. And I would get them, oh, okay, Oz. And they would move on. And so like, I remember every time there was a substitute, I had to like get myself like mentally prepared to be like, okay, ready for roll call. And I got to make sure that I cut them off at the pass and let them know so we can just move on and it doesn't become a thing. So I don't know. A lot of people look at that as like a bad thing or you had to go through that. I don't look at it that way at all. I just looked at it as like, that was something I had to think about at that age that maybe Brian and Jimmy and Susie didn't have to worry about, right? So teach their own. Last thing personally, you started in recruiting. Is that true?
Yeah. I didn't know the text.
That's not a bad word here, by the way. That's a great thing here on this podcast. I promise you that.
I don't think many people know that. Like, you don't get to know people and talent and functions and skill sets unless you're in recruiting. And like, I would never have expected that. But I was like, if I reflect, there are so many different roles that do so many different things. And like employers have a tendency of trying to cram as much as possible into a single individual to be able to save on OPEX and costs. But the fact is individuals are very, very distinct in what they've mastered. And so I'm always like, you know, if you had to master a craft, what would it be? That's your major. And then you've got a bunch of minors, but you can't ask a person to have three or four majors because instead of getting high quality outputs, you're just going to get a bunch of mediocre outputs. Some usable, some not usable. But I was the VP of business development, like, because I pivoted. I went from being a data engineer to a project manager to a business analyst. And then I got into this small agency that was LA based that grew to be fairly large, but I was their VP of talent sourcing, business development. And that's where I learned really the technical world at Scope. And this was in the early 2000s. I got to understand how companies were hiring, how they were looking at talent, how they were pulling them together or lack of. And so that's when I really got to know the breadth, depth, and span of technical talent that exists out there.
I love you saying this for this reason. All right, listen, my industry, one of the things that I absolutely did not love about it a lot coming up was that there's a stigma, right? It's seen as commoditized and transactional and car sales and things like that. And so I had to break down those barriers a lot of time when I meet people and say, no, there's an intellectual approach to take here. There's a data-driven approach to take here. There's a better way to do this, right? But what I would tell people, and a lot of times we've hired people with zero experience and kind of molded them in our own image here. And what I would tell people in interviews, especially in the first 5-6 years of the company is, hey, listen, you can go take 2 years and pay to get an MBA, or you can come here for a year and get an MBA while we pay you. And why I would say that is we've really forced people to learn different industries, different positions, different technologies. You had to have a baseline level knowledge of these different things that when you go to a cocktail party or you meet somebody and they're like, yeah, I'm the VP of supply chain at DHL. Like nobody knows what that is. You know, there's no follow up there for the common person. It's like, oh, really? Is it 3PL? What do you like? You can have a conversation with people that because you understand business at a deeper level. So I'm not going to credit your entire career to you starting in recruitment, but it doesn't sound like it hurt. All right, now I got to get to the main question. So why'd you write the book? What was the gap? What did you want to solve with this?
It was, you know, I have to give the credit to some other folks. To this day, like I write for Forbes and I wrote the book and I'm not a writer. Like that's not what I do. I'm all about delivery. I'm a practitioner that happened to make it to an executive level, but I still very much, I love doing, I love building. What had happened was when AI hit the market by storm, it was amazing to see how many AI advisors and experts cropped up out of nowhere. And you looked at their LinkedIn profile and like, they're a year old, year and a half into the space. How are they experts? And no one had deployed anything at scale. And so I got the encouragement of a few folks and like, so you've done this, you need to write about it. And I was like, why would people want to, because you've done it. No one else has done it. Everyone else is reading and regurgitating. So we called it the double R disease. You've actually done it. You can tell people what not to do, right? Whereas most people are telling them what to do and then figuring out what not to do while they're learning and earning. And I think that's part of the experience. Experience isn't about how to do things. Experience is about understanding context and what to avoid that matches that context. And so they're like, you need to write this. And I was like, why not? I guess I've resigned from enterprise. I am a free agent. I'm helping these startups. And every morning for 3 hours, I had a minimum word count and I didn't do any editing. I was like, just write brain dump. And I went through all of my files, did postmortems, lessons learned, looked at all the notes. And it magically kind of just came to me. It just came. And I was like, okay, here we go. I didn't think anything of it, but then I got picked up by a publisher, which was great. Wrote the book after I got picked up by a publisher. They said I was probably the fastest author to write the book, but because I had done the work, I wasn't doing research. I was literally writing about the work that I had done and where I had successes and where I had many failures and the reasons why.
I love that.
To help others to avoid the mistakes that I made because they're starting this journey and I've already been down this journey.
Oh, I love what you said about the people kind of propping up in the space. I mean, I always say this, always be worried with when somebody self-titles themselves with one of these two things, expert or leader. Those are things that to me, you've got to be called by, you got to be given that title. You got to be given that label more so than saying I'm an expert in AI. I've been doing this for a full 11 months and I can tell you backwards and forwards what it is. You actually have been doing this for such a long time. So I'm so glad that you wrote the book. Did you have a different working title? What was the first title you had in mind? Or was this the one from the beginning?
Oh God, we went through like 3 or 4, but the thing is that everyone wrote an AI book, but it was still very high level, still very either academic and research focused or very consultative. But my publisher was just like, listen, this is really about surviving an age where no one knows what they're doing. And so after maybe about 50 different title options,
what was your top choice though? What's on the cutting room floor?
Oh God, I don't even remember. I don't even remember. We had so many iterations.
I'm so fascinated by this process of writing a book and the titles and everything that comes with it. I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of people who've written books on the pod recently and just kind of going through that process, this idea of I want to write a book, the work that goes with it, and then how you like put it out into the world and like, you know, you lay yourself bare somewhat to like everybody else out there. But I can't speak enough about the value of it. So I think it's really, really good stuff. So there's a lot out there, and this is a great segue based on talking about the supposed experts. But you mentioned that there are a lot of imposters in the AI space right now. Are you talking about those people that profess to be experts, or are you talking about something more from a technology perspective?
Listen, there are a lot of advisors. Everyone's looking to gain financially from this. I mean, you can read every single Business Week, Wall Street Journal. You look at the major consulting firms. They are up $5+ billion in additional services because of AI and enterprises. All right. But, you know, not everyone works for a big four. Others own their own business or wanted to own their own business. And this was a wedge in because it was a free market. And so they created a wedge. So you have people who've never deployed it, consulting and advising. You've had people who technically don't understand it, consulting and advising. And you can create a business because what I've learned is the name of the game is always to stay a few inches ahead of the customer or the client. And as long as you do that, you're considered an expert. But I think that's a complete disjustice and it hurts my heart because you're not advising them on things that could go wrong or on areas where resources could be wasted, whether it's time, talent, or money. You're advising them on what to do next. And that's just wrong. I'm morally against it.
I like that. That's good stuff. Let's talk about this and then we're going to move into the hiring portion. So the media owns a lot of the messaging around AI and its current impact. We're seeing it in articles, news reports every day. There are so many signals out there. So I'm interested to hear from somebody who's as deep in the space as you are, what you're seeing. What do you think are kind of the key themes from these past couple of years going into the next year? And then what do you think we can look forward to as consumers and businesses in terms of AI, particularly in 2025? I don't want to get into super intelligence and everything that could be happening in the next 5, 10 years, whatever it may be. But what do you think is kind of the where we're at now and where we're going and what the impacts are going to be in this upcoming year?
I think 2023 was really the year focused on POCs and individual exploration. 2024 was focused on more POCs, but at scale and looking to push things into production. I think 2025 is going to filter and funnel some of the players out there because the cost to run these things is massive. I don't think we'll have as many players or maybe existing players, but the barrier to entry is going to be a lot harder. So we'll get a better feel of who the players are. We'll see some things that go to production but don't succeed. And then something that I'm personally very invested in is workforce management post AI. No one has thought of that or explored that. And part of the book is about that. It's about the people changes and the evolutions that need to occur to now accommodate and adapt this new technology. So I think there's an AI workforce and a human workforce. And the two, there isn't a playbook for how the two coexist. And that's what I'm interested
in. So I hate this term, but let's double click there. Cause I think that's an important one. I think it's what everybody just kind of on the periphery is thinking about, right? I've already seen the labor market start to be impacted in some ways. Although I think a lot of companies are using AI as a reason to do things that they want to do for their financial benefit in a lot of ways. Right? There is going to be some real evolution in application coming. One of the first, you know, real use cases that I've seen is the Klarna one, right? Where they really replaced all of their contact center, right? And did that through AI and reported higher numbers in terms of customer satisfaction and first call resolution and turning things around like that. We're going to start to see more of that application and there's going to be some displacement. Okay. But I'm an optimist. I come from the world of, you know, we thought that, you know, there was a lot of like horse buggy riders that when the car came around, we're out of jobs, but the jobs changed, right? There was more abundance of work. The productivity changed. So I what I believe is there will be some disruption over a short-term period, right? And there's a great book called The Technology Trap that I read that talks about this through the Industrial Revolution and things like that. But over the long term, the gains will be significant. What's your personal opinion on this? What would you tell people right now is kind of coming in the near term? And then what do you see in the long term in terms of how it impacts workforce? Big question, I know.
That is a big question. I don't know if it would do it justice in a podcast, but to summarize it, we're not ready. Mm. No one has considered the post-AI revolution operating model. And I have thought through that. I have a framework for it. I have an understanding for it. And this is what I want to educate and evangelize on. But we're not
ready. We're not ready. Okay. So there's going to be some disruption and a lot of butterfly effect and byproducts of this that we're not even planning for and ready for. And it doesn't sound like you think this is at the individual or company level alone. It sounds like at the societal level and macroeconomic level.
Yes. Oz, you and I come from a time period where like we were there pre-email, post-email. pre-internet, post-internet, pre-mobile devices, post-mobile devices, pre-big data / data processing, post, pre-apps, post-apps. Now we are seeing it pre-AI, post-AI. Each of these things I've mentioned has had a major societal impact on commerce, ethics, compliance. This is another one, and we're not ready yet.
Well, I don't know if I feel better or worse, but I will. We'll have to dig into that a little bit later in a longer format. But gosh, okay, let's dive into the hiring stuff, because I, as we talked about earlier, building software in the space, I didn't realize that AI was going to be such a big part of it so soon. Because when we were building it, I was thinking AI is probably in the not too distant future, but in the future, and it's going to cost a lot of money. But then it's really been democratized over the last 18 to 24 months, and it's become native to what we built. And so there's a lot of things that, from detecting biases to helping you generate requirements and questions to everything that you would potentially use it to augment that human experience that we're building. So this is an area I'm super keen on. You've done a lot of hiring in your life. So I'm interested to start here. You have a core hiring philosophy for people that you bring onto your team or bring into your organization.
I do. It doesn't always align with recruiting, HR, and talent acquisition.
That's okay.
Which is the problem. However, I do have a very strong hiring philosophy. I think special team matters, but I also don't like jerks on the team. I've made that mistake several times before. I also think that grit, like I can teach skills. A person can learn skills if they fundamentally have the aptitude and the interest. I have this one chapter in the book, for example, called How to Actually Work with the 10 Archetypes for Any AI Project. You get the naysayers, the curmudgeons, the know-it-alls, the cheerleader, the silent doer, like how to interplay everyone to make this capability grow stronger, because I do think everyone plays a role. Whether you like the person or not, put that aside, they all play a role. And so I always say, like, even with the naysayers and the curmudgeons, the people who are always negative, they do play a role. But you got to know when and how to apply those individual skill sets to maximize your output. And so when I come across those individuals, I'm like, oh, that's who they are. And that's the role they're playing. As an example, the naysayers and the curmudgeons, they oftentimes are extremely brilliant. They've been within the company for quite a bit of time. They have no energy to do anything new because they've seen too many things fail. Totally get it. But they're phenomenal at pointing out everything that can go wrong. And so I actually use them to call out my blind spots. After I've gone through strategy, use case selection, after I've understood the project plan, the resources, the cost, and I've done all the functional specing. Before I go into solution architecture and technical specing, I bring those folks in and I say, all right, I don't say, tell me everything that's wrong with it. I call it a review, and they naturally tell me everything that's wrong with it. I think there's an opportunity to leverage a lot of different talent and skill sets to drive a capability forward, but I don't believe in over-inclusiveness. I don't want 22 people on a single call. I keep the teams lean, mean. I appreciate their specialty. I bring on specialty skill sets because I know that they can master this craft. And it's kind of like an orchestra, and I view myself as a bit of a maestro. Everyone has a field of play, but they need to know their field of play really well. Two, they have to have resilience and grit. And three, with all due respect, but the things that I've built and the things I can do, you can't do from a 9:30 to 4:30 job. And some folks are just mentally checked out, can't be mentally checked out, not with this stuff, because there's a lot of problem solving to be had. And that just requires mental capacity and energy. So I have a good way of coming in and assessing teams, and I've managed teams as large as 832 and as small as 175. My largest team is 175. I can easily come in and understand everyone's part in the storybook and how they're going to play, if they're going to play and have a role in it. And then I'm very, very clear on expectations. But yeah, we can get into the sausage making a little bit.
There's a lot of people listening to this right now and nodding their head and loving a lot of the things that you said. I love, and one of the things I heard from you was that specialization is about aptitude, technical skill set, but it's also about roles you play and how you bring yourself to work. And all of those can be important. I love you calling out the naysayers, where there's usually people in the back room saying, oh my God, I can't believe this person's doing that. But you're looking at that as somebody that can actually help the project advance and move forward and call out those blind spots. I think that's a really important reframing. I usually ask about a memorable interview experience, but I want to take this a little bit of a different direction. I want to know about the most unique interview experience you ever had, because you've taken on some of these really big jobs, but is there one that really stood out to you, either because it was a great candidate experience or it wasn't a great experience, or it was fast, it was slow? Well, what stands out to you when I ask you about the most unique interview experience you've had?
I would say the first one was Royal Caribbean. I was a partner at EY, and I was working, and an individual named Mike Giresi was a phenomenal CIO. He's the one that brought me in. But then leadership changed. Then they brought in another brilliant individual named Jay to lead, and he became the chief digital officer. And he came from Disney. And I thought he was going to bring in his own team, and we were all going to be replaced with his own consulting company and preferences and et cetera. Long story short, I just showed up and shared everything I knew, thinking I would be replaced because we have a new leadership. We don't have relationships. And it turned into he wanted to hear more, and he asked more questions. And when he asked more questions, I was very open. Like, actually, I don't know the answer to that. We're figuring that out now. Or we do, but here are my speculations about it. And then 4 months later, they offered me a job, right? I was very honest and very sincere. And I had accepted the fact that I may be replaced. But instead, they gave me a job. That was probably the most unique and the most amazing. I would say the other ones, however, all great employers, great brands. But, you know, there is a discrepancy between the aspirations of a company and the perspiration of a company, what they want to do and what they're willing to do to get there. And there's always been a major delta between sort of like the story of where they want to be versus what they're willing to do. And that's always been a hiccup for me.
Hmm. I love that. That's really good stuff. And that's amazing that you kind of went in that with that attitude of like, I know that I'm probably not long for here. You are genuine and authentic. That probably opened their eyes quite a bit, and it led to a really important career opportunity for you. So good advice. What about questions you like to ask in an interview that you think cut through things? Maybe they're a little provocative. Is there anything in particular that you love to ask in an interview session that you think is really good?
I do. And I know we're wrapping up here, but I think this is a great way to wrap up. My favorite question is, tell me about a time where you messed up and something you'll never do again.
Mm.
It's simple. It's basic, but you get to test the humility. Sometimes people have to think about it. And if they have to think a really long time, it's one of two things. They haven't taken enough risks, or they're trying to figure out how to spin the story.
I love that.
But it's a good way of understanding if someone's willing to admit where they tried something and it just didn't work out. Because that way, if they're part of my leadership team, I always want the honest answer. And I can gauge if someone's willing to be honest or not based on that one question.
Are you open to sharing any time that that's been the case for you?
Oh, God. Half the book is all my mistakes. The entire book is all the mistakes I made.
You do. You're very humble and self-efficacing in that.
I only learn through failure, which is a hard lesson learned because it hurts me. But I only learn through failure, and unfortunately. I can read, but unless I do and make the mistakes, it doesn't sink in.
All right. So I know you got to run to another meeting. I really appreciate you making the time. I'm looking forward to working with you in the future. Thank you for coming on the podcast, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, this was amazing. Thank you, Oz. I really appreciate it. Keep doing the good work, man.
All right. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.